Going backwards, space is just a word made up by someone who's afraid to get too close. Close ain't close enough. That's Nick Jonas. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. And do you have any idea how few lyrics there are about a bat getting thrown and caught in a net for several innings? Even if you try to find some sort of metaphor of something dangling or twinkling in the night sky, very little that fits a baseball bat. That was, in John Schneider's estimation, unfortunately, the most entertaining part of yesterday's game. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. losing his bat, gets caught in the protective netting, takes the Blue Jays a couple innings and some ingenuity from Chris Bassitt to get that thing down. Not a lot of offense otherwise. The Jays keep inching closer to 500, but haven't been able to quite get there since late April. Asymptotic for you math nerds. You math nerds might also realize that scoring zero or one runs, as the Jays have done 15 times already this year, does not give you a very good chance to win a baseball game. Colin Ray and the Brewers shut them down 3-1 on Monday. All of that offense coming from an Alejandro Kirk solo home run. Let's break it down. Joined by Joe Siddle of Sports Setup Blue Jay Central. He was on the call for this one. Joe, good morning. How are you, man?
Morning, Blake. All is well.
Ever seen anything quite like spending two innings covering a bat trying to get pulled down from the netting?
Well, Dan and I were joking after the game, and I'm glad we had something to talk about. It was one of those nights. Yes, I guess you try to have fun with those things after the Kikuchi collision on Sunday in Oakland. You like to have fun with things like that in the broadcast. But as you know, Blake, we'd rather be talking about runs being scored from this Blue Jays offense, and it's not happened very, very well.
It is absolutely not. So at least the one thing I guess you could say yesterday is, well, the Jays didn't struggle with runners in scoring position or leave many guys on base, and that's because they didn't have any. What do you make of that? I know Colin Ray's had a nice season, can mix in six different pitches. You know, the Jays said afterwards they were kind of sitting on the fastball, and he went away from it and threw, you know, he's got five other pitches he can go to. Again, I know Ray's had a nice season, but this isn't a guy with high-end stuff. This is a guy who other teams have hit hard and just got a little unlucky against. Jay's not able to do much against another kind of kitchen sink guy like this.
Yeah, but we seem to say that about all kinds of different pitchers, yeah, don't we? We got high velocity guys with good sliders. We got guys that are 92 to 94 with cutters and sweepers. I mean, you can describe any human being that pitches, and it seems like we're having these conversations. I mean, sooner or later, not only do you have to hit these guys, but you also have to hit the elite pitchers in the game if you think you're going anywhere in this game. We know what October baseball is like, and if that's what the game plan is to get to postseason baseball, that's what you're getting. And quite frankly, it's probably why they bowed out pretty quickly against the Minnesota Twins. You know, it was Lopez and Sonny Gray, and they just stymied them, and it shouldn't have been a real surprise after what we saw throughout the course of the season. We're seeing a lot of it again this year.
No, and like it or not, teams are going to, even the teams with very good pitching, are going to shorten those games and go to their bullpen earlier. A team like the Brewers, you know, they've had okay starting pitching, but they've got an entire rotation on the IL. They're kind of doing a supersized version of what the Jays have had to do with their number five spot there. And yeah, they've just got a really good bullpen. So even if they had gotten to Colin Ray a little earlier, there's an army of one inning guys, one and two inning guys behind that. What do you make, Joe, of the fact that, so there was a good stretch of the season where the Jays would tell us, hey, the offense wasn't there, but the swing decisions are good. We're working good plate appearances. We're getting long at bats and things like that. We're getting into bullpens earlier. Lately, it does seem that they've shifted to be maybe a little bit more aggressive, but the offensive results haven't quite come, and they're not getting, like, Colin Ray got through seven innings on like 85 pitches or 85, 86 pitches yesterday. Like, they are not, this happened in the Oakland series as well, where Mitch Spence was able to go seven and things like that. They're also not now grinding guys down. What do you make of that? Is this just the transition to trying to be a little bit more aggressive now, and it's not working out?
Well, I don't really put a lot of stock into grinding out a pitcher and getting into bullpens, not in today's game. Now, if you're facing Corbin Burnes, you might want to take that sort of approach, but at the same time, you're going to sit around against a guy like that. You don't want to get deep into account against those good pitchers either. So I think it's a little overrated, Blake. Like, to me, it's each individual at bat is a different individual going up there, and you take your approach, your swing, however you go about it. I don't think you should need to be told as a major league, this is what we're doing today. We're going to work the count. We're going to make sure something's center cut. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And it just seems like there are so many guys going up to the plate. Like, there were a few last night. how many times have you heard hitters, hitting coaches say, be on time for the fastball? And it just seems like a lot of times they're not on time for the fastball. And you had mentioned with Ray last night, maybe they were looking for the heater a little bit more and he had the other stuff. But I mean, there seems to be everybody that goes up, like there is one time, I think it was Bowie, first pitch, sweeper way down and away at the bottom of the zone and hits it weakly and pops up. Well, that's not a good approach, right? Now, you may go up looking for that pitch and you get it, you see spin, so you come under your shoes a little bit. I like that approach, but there's where, you know, sure, I'll agree with you, it's not a good swing decision, but it's also a breaking pitch that looked good most of the way. But so the swing decisions, I get it, but I prefer the aggressive nature and also aggressive on the fastball. But in saying that, there are also times when guys are late on fastballs. And if you're late on fastballs, first pitch or middle of the count, whenever it is, I mean, two-strike is a little different. I still don't like this whole two-strike approach thing. I think if your approach is good from the outset of an at-bat, from the first pitch, it should be good for the whole at-bat. And there's no reason to be, like, late on fastballs in the middle of the count. And we've seen guys like Vladdy's continuing at times to get beat. And the reason I'm mentioning these names is because this is the top of the lineup, right? Yeah. These are the guys that need to perform if this lineup's going anywhere. I mean, my goodness, it's June 10th, and Davis Schneider's the Blue Jays' leadoff hitter, and Spencer Horwitz is hitting second. And in all due respect to both of those hitters, this is not the way it was supposed to go, right? So there are just a lot of hitters in this lineup, to sum it up, I think, that you can pitch to, that are easy to pitch to. And if you want to say that there are a lot of guys that are kind of like number six hitters, like you want to say, the argument continues. Dan and I talked about on the broadcast last night, you know, who would you lead off? How would you? Well, how many more times can you shake this lineup up? Like, pretty soon, we got to just summarize here by saying there aren't enough good hitters. And that's the issue right now, and that's the issue this season. It was part of the issue last year. So rather than diving and delving into all that swing decision stuff and approach at the plate and looking for a fastball or grinding out starting pitchers and trying to get in the bullpen and all that, it's like, my goodness, we're not seeing the forest through the trees here. There are just some approaches that guys can be easily pitched to, and that makes life pretty easy for a Colin Ray last night.
Yeah, and look, I mean, if you needed a very high fidelity example of that, look at the last pitch of the game. Vlad got 99.5 right down the middle. And that's a ground out for first pitch, right? Like, hey, jumped on it. He was aggressive, but he got challenged and lost. And I know he hit it hard, but a ground out's a ground out in that situation. Yeah. So,
you're right, Blake. It's 100 miles an hour. But I mean, we set up by saying that. I mean, if I'm McGill, there's no way he's getting a breaking pitch for me. Here's my heater. And I know if anything, you might hit a single with it, but you're not going to hit it out of the park and tie the game. So you just go right after him. I mean, that's where, and again, it's really hard to pick on Vladdy, but at the same time, he is supposed to be that guy that's kind of carrying the offense. And it's not going to happen if you're not hitting the ball out of the ballpark. But I just find up and down the lineup, Blake, there are a lot of guys. And I mean, I could go over each player individually because each hitter is different, right? Swings are different from all hitters. But they're just like, you know, as good as Dalton Varsho has been at times this year, you know, if you can keep that changeup down and away, you're going to get him to roll over. You know, with Springer, if you can keep that ball down and especially down and away, he's probably going to roll something over. And there are just guys that you can do a lot of things to. And that's what I mean by saying easy to pitch to. I mean, every hitter has weaknesses. You can't cover all of the zones. But I think too many of them are pretty glaring in a lot of these hitters.
Yeah, I mean, who's coming up in a big spot? Like, I mean, you said it really well there with McGill last night. It's like, yeah, well, I don't think Vlad's going to hit it out, so I can just challenge him. And if it's, you know, if he gets a single, okay, well, we still got a two-run lead, and then the next guy's got to hit. The league is hitting like 239, 240. You're probably not going to string together 3, 4, 5 hits all that often. And Joe, with respect to the batting order, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, like the fact that the top of the order were all being called the Buffalo Boys a couple of months ago, that's because they were in AAA and they maybe weren't going to make the team. Maybe not the solution at 1-2. I do want to give some credit to Spencer Horwitz, though. He had two hits last night, takes one the other way for a double in the first, and then inside outs one for a single in the ninth that extended that game. I know he made the base running mistake right after he had that double, but what have you made of his first couple games up here at the plate?
Well, I'd throw him in the leadoff spot right now, to be honest with you. I think Davis, he can drop down. And I'm a big fan of Davis Schneider. When I talk about a lot of guys, and I know he's going through a struggle right now, but when I look at his swing and I slow it down and I watch some video, I actually like a lot of things about Davis Schneider's swing. Sounds silly because he's going through it right now, but because he presents that danger, and when he is right, he's good. But I'd rather see him down in 5-6, you know, and coming up in those types of situations. Spencer's a guy that gets on base, and it's interesting. He's only been up here for a little bit here, but I'm seeing more of an aggressive natured hitter. I'm not seeing a guy like that we hear about that draws a ton of walks and gets on base that way. So, but that's the way, I mean, he's trying to make his mark too. And I would just throw him up there right now. He gives you a good AB and see how it goes. I think, again, you can shuffle things the way you want. There is really no, and I don't even want to call it a prototypical leadoff hitter, because I'm not even sure what that is in the game anymore. But, you know, obviously you want that guy to get on base for the other guys. But, you know, I mentioned to John Schneider last night, I said, you know, what do you like about Davis 1 and Horwitz 2? And he just said about the ability to get on base for Vladdy, basically. But then you've got your, quote, aircraft carrier hitting a lot of singles. So does that do any good? It's things are dysfunctional. This lineup's got all kinds of issues. You know, we see it. You get a little excited about it when they score some runs against the Oakland A's. But then you come into Milwaukee and you're facing a team that's pretty decent pitching team. But they've been ravaged by injuries. And now they're going to face the kid, it looks like, sounds like tonight, that's making his major league debut.
Yeah, and, you know, Carlos Rodriguez is, I'm going to break it down on Blue Jay Central a little later. He doesn't throw all that hard, but he's got five different pitches, and he works the fastball up in the zone, and he's got two breaking balls low that move in different directions. You know, we've heard this.
What could go wrong?
We've heard this one before, right? Joe, with respect to Horwitz, nice stuff at the plate. The base running blunder yesterday, maybe just, you know, a little overexcited, not entirely locked in. What have you made of his defense at second base? I know we haven't seen a ton of it yet, but I know you were also pretty fond of his kind of fake out on, I think it was Willy Adames or Bryce Terang who stole there, and he did the kind of fake out when the ball went by to make sure he didn't pop up and take an extra base there.
Yeah, I mean, you see a lot of players do that. It's not a real unique thing, but it's a nice heads-up play by a player getting a chance at the big league level at a new position. And, you know, sometimes that's just enough. All you need is a split second in terms of a decoy there, and it just freezes him for that split second, and then, boom, there's no way he's getting up and going to third. So, yeah, I thought it was just a nice. I like those little unique plays that happen throughout the course of a game. It wasn't a very good throw, obviously, and ideally you want to block that pitch, that ball, so it doesn't get into center field. But I think he's been okay. We haven't seen a ton of action yet. I know there was one in Oakland, and it might have been in his first game. There was a pop-up in his shallow right field, and I was hoping George would come in and help him out and make the play, and he didn't. And he made a really, really good play, a really tough play going out into right field. That's never a lot of fun, but certainly holding his own right now. He made a nice play coming in the other day, so we'll see how that works. But I don't see any reason why he shouldn't get a little bit of a run here, especially with that left-handed bat. And if he can keep getting on base, a couple more hits last night, which is a good thing. And we'll see how that plays. I mean, I've always said, you know, I don't necessarily translate numbers from AAA to just coming to the big leagues and doing it. But with the way the lineup is, Blake, he's certainly entitled to that opportunity, and I hope he can make the most of it.
Yeah, string of righties still ahead here, too. Rodriguez, who will come up tonight, is a righty. Tobias Myers tomorrow is a righty. And, Joe, you're right. Yeah, I know you don't like to translate the numbers. You had a great breakdown on the weekend on the broadcast of the amount of high-end velocity that Spencer Horwitz has faced in AAA versus, you know, someone who's at the top of a major league lineup. Now, this series isn't the best example of it because the Brewers don't have starters who have that high-end velocity. But is that, in your estimation as a hitter, is that the biggest challenge when a guy makes this jump, is that, you know, there's just every single guy you're going to face has good stuff?
Yeah, no, not really, Blake. I mean, I don't want to put too much into the velocity. It's just, it's stating a fact that it is different up here. But my point was the gap is so big, I think, in AAA in the big leagues now than back when I played. Like, I remember being in AAA, and I don't know how long it's been like this, but, like, guys in AAA, you faced, like, a lot of, like, 31-year-old veteran guys that had played in the big leagues for parts of a few seasons, and they're trying to get back. And they're pretty savvy guys. Like, you might face a Colin Ray type in AAA. And I remember facing those guys, and it's like, these guys know how to pitch. Now it's probably more about the big arms and all, but because of all the injuries in the game, it seems, and you and I talked about it, it seems like a lot of the guys are getting called up. I mean, if you're 95, 98, you're getting called up because we want to use you right now before you get hurt. And with all the injuries in the game, and Milwaukee's a perfect example here, they get those guys up. But I think it's more the quality overall of the competition. So you're just facing a lot of pitchers that not just necessarily have an idea, but a lot of them happen to be higher velocity guys at the big leagues because that's where they're going. Like, teams are using them. So that's a factor, but I think the bigger factor is, again, each individual hitter is different. Spencer Horwitz's swing is different than Davis Schneider, is different than George Springer, is different than Dalton Varsho. You know, righty, lefty, it doesn't matter. Everybody has unique characteristics in their swing. And I think with Spencer, for me, it would be the one that I'll be keeping an eye on, is there appears to me at times that he's kind of leaking early, and then his hands is a bit of a push. And when I say that, as opposed to turning the barrel and getting on plane early and getting out into the zone and catching things up front, I'll keep an eye on that. So when you push, it tends to be a little handsy, which sometimes you can roll over to the pull side. We see Dalton do that a lot. That's why he's such a dead red pull hitter. And again, everybody's so different, but that's in my early returns, that's one thing I'm watching in Spencer's swing.
Yeah, Varsho, dead red pull bunter yesterday as well.
That works too.
Yeah, almost didn't in that one. And then we got the big divot in the field. So the one run the Blue Jays got yesterday was on an Alejandro Kirk home run. We have not seen as much of Alejandro Kirk lately because Danny Jansen has kind of run with the lion's share of that playing time. Now, Danny Jansen's come back down to earth a little bit at the plate. Are you seeing some good stuff from Kirk up there? I know it's just the one home run, but his numbers over the last couple of weeks in that part-time role are a little better.
Yeah, no, he's been much better, I think, Blake, and that's not just the home run. It's been for a little while now. And, yes, playing sparingly, but also that could be the reason, right? Playing sparingly, he's a little bit more well-rested, and he's well-rested. You're not fatigued as much because we know when he's had those good runs, and especially the beginning of the season when Danny was on the injured list, and it's a lot. It doesn't play well into his game. And fatigue can show or work in many different ways, and especially as a catcher, right, when you're logging nine innings behind the plate and you're playing every day, and he certainly doesn't seem to be that type of player that can withstand that. So if you play him in your right spots, keep him rested, you're going to get the best version of him. And I think that home run was a perfect example last night. When he, or any hitter for that matter, when you fatigue, you do things to try to create because you're trying to make up for something because the fatigue is there. And especially in the bottom half for hitters, it's so important. But I thought his move to the baseball is much more controlled. It showed last night. And what I mean by controlled, it's not like where you're jumping out there, and most hitters will say that probably the number one thing when you're scuffling as a hitter is you're drifting forward, you're getting out there. It's just not a good thing because the fastball gets on you too fast, then you rush to it, you don't pick up spin on the breaking ball very well, so you chase it. Just all bad things happen when you need to rush. But he looked very controlled. That's a great thing. He gets that good stretch, and I don't know if you noticed his turn, but it was almost like a half, like he didn't even really follow through. And I know some people will say that looks funny and that's not a good swing, but it's because he got such a good stretch with the hands back and then the quick, tight turn. That's a good thing. And you don't need to. I mentioned Mookie Betts' name because you'll see him do it a lot. And, of course, he's one of the best there is. But much improved. I really like what I've seen from Kirk over the last little while. And, hey, with Danny struggling, maybe that playing time goes back and forth. But for John Schneider, it's finding that happy medium. I think Danny can play every day. It doesn't really matter. But for Kirk, you might just have to pick your spots. Maybe he catches back-to-back days, but then has a couple off, whatever the case may be. But if he keeps doing this, he might keep finding himself in the lineup a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a nice luxury to have. And it's always seemed that both of those guys do a little better when they're not in there every single day, which I'm sure the catching position is very hard, Joe. So it makes some sense there. On the other side of the ball, Jose Berríos, I mean, not really fair to any of the Jays pitchers right now, the thin margins of error they have to work with. He was getting behind a lot, though, yesterday. He didn't throw the first pitch strike a lot. I think there were nine hitters he got down 2-0 to. I know he said after the game he wasn't super comfortable with the way the slurve was coming out, that breaking ball of his, and it obviously a couple of those mistakes got hit hard. What did you make, though, of him falling behind with that level of consistency?
Well, you know, Blake, it's a funny thing, and I think we would all agree, everyone in baseball, every pitching coach in baseball would agree that you have to work ahead. You got to work ahead. We all keep saying you got to work ahead. Strike one's the most important pitch in baseball. But, you know, I keep an eye on that throughout the course of a game, and I didn't mention it much last night because he was pitching well. But after the second inning, he retired the order in the first inning, in order, retired three batters straight. Base hit in the second inning, and there was a stolen base, but he gets the next three guys. So really, he faced seven batters through two innings, absolutely pretty much dealing, right? But he threw one out of the first seven batters, strike one. So terrible numbers, but the results were good. So I don't think it's, once there's that word overrated again. To me, yeah, you might fall behind, but he has the ability to, he's got such good stuff that it didn't really hurt him. Now, throughout the course of a game, is that a good approach? Absolutely not. But I don't get too caught up in that as opposed to the results. Because if I throw ball one and then I throw a really good changeup down and away and get a lefty to roll over, right, he's got that stuff to be able to do those things. So I don't look into that a whole lot. I think he maybe wasn't his necessarily sharpest, but let's not kid ourselves. He left two curveballs on the plate that if he could have those two pitches back, it's probably a 1-0 game for the Blue Jays in the sixth inning, right, with Kirk's home run. So, I mean, yeah, if, lots of things. But I thought he was fine, and I don't put tons of stock into that. But, those two pitches, that breaking pitch for me, it's so funny. His splits are backwards this year. He's actually much better against lefties. But I think that's a big part of it is with righties. A, he's in the middle of the plate sometimes too much with the sinker, but B, that curveball, when he's really good, we know where it is, right? It's down and away, just off that outside corner at the knees. And when he's on, it kind of backs up and spins and stays on the plate a lot. Both home runs did that.
Yeah, and you know, to your point about the getting behind in the count maybe doesn't matter all that much when you have that level of pitchability. The home runs he gave up were 2-2 and 1-2. So those weren't the 2-0 counts that he had gotten himself into. Anyway, he managed to find his way out of a lot of those. Yusei Kikuchi tonight, Joe, he's coming off what, in my estimation, given the quality of competition, was his best start of the season against the Orioles. He had a couple shakier ones before that where, you know, the fastball velocity was down a little bit. He wasn't getting as much swing and miss with the breaking ball. This is a Brewers team that can really hit and can really run when they do get on base. What are you looking for from Yusei Kikuchi tonight?
Well, they're a good fastball hitting team too, and we know he's got the heater, and it was good against the Orioles, and that's good to see. He got lots of swings and misses with that pitch. Will he use that again tonight against the team? You know, we know the Orioles are not, we know, but it seems like they're a team that kind of sits soft a little bit at times, right? So the fastball was good for Yusei, and he really took advantage of it. But maybe, you know, there are a couple of hitters, and I thought this was interesting, just kind of doing a little bit of work this morning. A few of the hitters are actually better against righties. A few right-handed hitters, Adames, Contreras, and Ortiz, they're all better against righties than lefties. And that can happen maybe because you face more of them. But a little bit of a quirk there that could work into Yusei's favor, and we'll see how Pat Murphy constructs his lineup tonight. But I'm looking for a lot more of the same. I mean, he has four weapons now, and I think it's fair to say, like, four legit weapons. He can go heavy fastball if he wants. He could go heavier curveball. The changeup he's used more on occasion now, too. So I don't think it matters, and we know he's always got that kind of wipeout slider, even though at times it's been hit pretty good. So he can go a lot of different angles, and I think he can just feel it out and see what that lineup is doing and if they're aggressive. But if not, go ahead and use it. We know he likes to spin the baseball, and the curveball has been a really big pitch for him this season. So I think it's a good thing that he can even be a little bit more unpredictable. If you're the Brewers lineup preparing for Yusei Kikuchi right now, tonight, I wouldn't know what to expect, whether he's going to be fastball heavy or if he's going to spin it more. And that's a good thing for Kikuchi to be that unpredictable, to have those four good weapons.
Joe, before you go down to the park, is Dan Shulman dragging you to, like, Green Bay Packers OTA workouts or anything like that? Is he giving you the full cheesehead Wisconsin tour?
He told me he went to the Packers store yesterday and got some goodies. He got his Green Bay Packers pin on his lapel pin yesterday. I think he was close to wearing a cheesehead for our open, but, well, you got to control him a little bit. You know, I'm a Lions fan.
Yeah.
I'm just not in the right country here.
No, you guys will have to have it out in the North Division this year. Joe Siddle, thanks for taking the time this morning, man.
All right, Blake, have a great day.
Joe Siddle, on color next to Dan Shulman for this series, always on the Sportsnet broadcast, either on the broadcast or Blue Jays Central. So the Jays lose 3-1. Again, not a lot of offense. They only got four hits. One of them was a bunt single from Dalton Varsho that Colin Ray kind of misplayed. They got two hits from Spencer Horwitz and the solo shot from Alejandro Kirk. Tonight, we'll continue to tee this one up throughout the day. And Joe mentioned there, you maybe don't know which Yusei Kikuchi you're getting because he can go to so many different options. This Brewers team saw him 2 years ago. Obviously, that was a much less effective version of Yusei Kikuchi than we see now. He had an ERA up over 5. In that outing, he went, and get this, this is how much things change in 2 years, by the way. So not only did Kikuchi have an ERA over 4, walked a batter and gave up 2 home runs in 2 innings. He only went 2 innings, gave up 5 runs, only 2 of them earned, though. And he was followed in the bullpen by 2 innings from Trent Thornton and 4 from Platinum Max Castillo. So that's how long ago 2 years was. Raimel Tapia was in that lineup. Bradley Zimmer, Gabriel Moreno caught that game. Things change pretty quickly. So wouldn't put a ton of stock into the fact that this Brewers team has hit .333 against Kikuchi with a .500 slugging. He does have 8 strikeouts in 18 at-bats against them. So there's a mixed bag there. And again, anytime you're looking at team or player versus pitcher, you got to acknowledge the fact that Kikuchi was not this guy 2 years ago. And a lot changes for both hitters and pitchers over the course of 2 years. On the Brewers side, they're expected to call up Carlos F. Rodriguez, one of their prospects from the minor leagues for this one. Again, I'll break down Rodriguez's stuff on Blue Jays Central later tonight, and a little bit in this show if we get some time here in the second half. He's kind of a, I don't want to say a non-prospect, but he was ranked 19th in the organization, started the season at AAA. He's got a 5.17 ERA down there, okay strikeout rate, probably walks a couple too many guys, but not terribly high. And then you dig into some of the AAA numbers, and he doesn't have a crazy amount of swing and miss or chase rate or anything like that. He just kind of does a lot of things medium well. It's a fastball that's like 92, 93, but he locates it really well up in the zone. And then you've got a handful of breaking balls. He's got both a slider and a curveball. He has that have good swing and miss rates on them. He throws a changeup. He has a sinker to play off of the fastball. So not dissimilar to a Colin Ray approach that we saw yesterday, or, you know, all of the Oakland guys who were just kind of, I guess Medina has a lot of fastball velocity there, but some of the other Oakland pitchers who were just kind of mixing and matching. Particularly a Hogan Harris. A couple of small updates for you. Still no word on Kevin Biggio. Obviously, he was designated for assignment on Friday. Jays have a few days here before they need to expose him to waivers to work out a trade or something like that. That has not happened yet. Alec Manoah's UCL surgery is scheduled for next Monday. We're going to talk to Shai Davidi at 11 o'clock and go through a lot of the specifics there. He had a great piece at sportsnet.ca talking to Manoah about what the last couple weeks have been like. Yariel Rodriguez makes a rehab start today for AAA Buffalo. He's hoping to get up to 70, 75 pitches. He's gone as far as 58 in his last outing, if we include the bullpen session that he did after the fact. So he's getting pretty close here. Jordan Romano threw from 60 feet on Sunday and 75 feet yesterday. He's going to have to work up to 150 feet off flat ground before he throws off a mound, but trending in the right direction there. And John Schneider said yesterday that he felt good. So Jay's got to get through these next two. Then they have their first off day Thursday in 13 days. They'll have played 13 straight. Then they've got 6 more, an off day, 17 more before their next off day. So it's a pretty compressed schedule here. It does offer you some flexibility to move that bullpen day if you want, if you don't want to give your guys the extra day of rest and you'd rather kind of go into that Cleveland series. Of course, there's no good option because then it's Boston. So you've got to use that bullpen day somewhere against Cleveland or Boston in that 6 set there, but you could juggle it around if they so choose, whether that's to do with Yariel Rodriguez's availability, how the bullpen goes the next couple of days, what the kind of rest and recovery is feeling like for a Kikuchi, for a Bassett, and things like that. Let's take a break. Let's get to know the Brewers side of this matchup a little better. We're going to talk to Derek Van Riper of The Athletic, of the Rates and Barrels podcast. Again, we'll talk to Shai Davidi in the second hour, and Eric Thames, former Blue Jay and former Brewer, who you may have seen crushing beers on the broadcast yesterday, is expected to join us around 11:30 as well. All that is next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL, the JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, coming back in with a little promise ring, Milwaukee's finest export. Let's get to know this Brewers team that beat the Blue Jays yesterday a little bit better. Let's tag in Derek Van Riper of The Athletic, of Rates and Barrels. Derek, what's up, man? How are you?
Hey, Blake. Thanks for having me on. How are you doing?
Good, man. I don't know. We worked at The Athletic at the same time. I don't think we ever really crossed paths on anything. So this is it's nice to chat with you. So Brewers got the win yesterday. Before we get into the specifics of that team, generally like to ask guests from outside the city what you make of a pretty underwhelming Toronto Blue Jays season thus far. What's your outside perspective on this Jays squad?
I just can't figure out why they don't do more damage. That's the strangest thing about that lineup. I mean, just 2 years ago, they were third in Major League Baseball in slugging percentage behind the Braves and Dodgers, and the young core they had is still in place. So to me, that's the most baffling and frustrating thing about them. They should have that pop in the lineup consistently, and they just don't. The one thing they still do pretty well, they did a couple of years ago when they kind of put this core together, was they became a team that didn't strike out a lot. Right, every at bat was going to be a challenge. But if guys can't do damage, you're not as worried about getting beat. So I don't know where the blame falls exactly. I've wondered for a while if Vlad Jr. has the curse of a great hit tool, where if he were a little more selective, maybe he would drive pitches more often. Bo Bichette, I think, is even a bigger mystery, at least in the case of Vladdy. We've seen him turn it around a little bit in the last 30 games or so. But Bo Bichette just looks lost. And I don't know if it's a case where maybe he has a opposite field approach that does not fit what needs to happen to get to power right now. But he's probably the most disappointing hitter for me, maybe in the entire league right now, based on my expectations, because I thought he was a very high floor player and he's been brutal so far.
Yeah, and he's supposed to be a high floor player, right? Like, the hit tool is so great. And even though he expands the zone, the contact profile is really strong. He actually, weirdly, he has the highest contact rate of his career. But, you know, in so much as we can track these things, the swing decisions are kind of he's never a guy that we want to be like, hey, you got to be super selective, you got to be super patient. Like, you want an aggressive version of Bo Bichette, but even by his standards, you know, swinging at a lot of stuff outside of the zone, like almost a 38% chase rate at this point, which is like, even if you can get to it, you're not going to do a lot of damage with that stuff, right? You know, as much as we can quantify it as well, the defense has also slipped back a little bit at shortstop. It's been a tough go. It's been a friendlier go for your Milwaukee Brewers, who are just kind of cruising here. I know they had a tough series against the Phillies. They had like a little bit of a home run drought there, but they are top of the NL Central by far. Good vibes, pretty versatile team. How are we feeling about the Brewers overall?
Really good. I mean, I think a lot of people around here were worried about the departure of Craig Counsell. How would Pat Murphy connect with this club? Because it seemed like of all the things that Counsell does well, he was on the same page with the players the majority of the time. So clubhouse harmony seems important when you mix and match as often as the Brewers have in recent years. And it seems like it's actually better under Pat Murphy than it was under Craig Counsell, which is hard to believe. They've got contributions coming from all different places. I mean, at the top, Christian Yelich has been great in the 40 games he's been out there. He had one stint on the IL, but he's hitting the ball hard. He's pulling barrels again. That's what Yelich did when he had MVP caliber production a few seasons ago. So that's huge. But, you know, William Contreras taking a step forward at the plate's been huge. Bryce Turang kind of having a season like the one Andrés Giménez had a couple years ago in Cleveland is amazing. He's more than just a great defender at second base. He's become a table setter. They're getting a bounce back from Willy Adames, who had a concussion last year that really seemed to impact him throughout the second half of the season. And then it's guys that people haven't really heard a lot about, like Blake Perkins as fill-ins. Like, you get these guys that come up and they're at least league average players that are great defenders, and it goes a really long way towards protecting you through IL stints. So I've been impressed by that lineup, just having so much balance in it. It still has a little bit too much swing and miss. So I think that's one area to maybe nitpick, where if they're going up against playoff caliber rotations, they might go a little quiet. And that's exactly what the Phillies are. So I think that might be a little bit of a warning sign of what their biggest weakness is. But yeah, they've had great contributions all over the place. And they still have a guy in Jackson Chourio who could get a lot better over the course of the season. I think one of the more fascinating things major league teams have to do right now, if they're competitive and they have a top prospect like that, is balance out the playing time in a way where that guy gets a chance to keep getting better, but he's not a liability in the lineup. And so far they've walked that line pretty effectively, and we're starting to see some signs. You saw the home run last night from Chourio. Maybe it's starting to come together for him.
Yeah, and even with Chourio and Joey Ortiz graduated, this is still a team with one of the best farm systems in baseball too. So you look at that sustainability of this success, you know, the fact that they've survived all these starting pitching injuries, which we'll talk about in a second. But, you know, even if you think ahead to being buyers at the deadline, you know, you do have that rich farm system there. So things look pretty good. And obviously you obviously, trading away Corbin Burns always hurts, but Joey Ortiz has looked pretty good too there. And Jack Soturio, we even saw him get intentionally walked in a big spot last night. Were you a little surprised to see that?
Very surprised to see that. I mean, he takes pretty high quality at bats for a player his age, but at the same time, I would not intentionally walk him yet. I don't think we're at that point in his career.
Yeah, it's. I guess, to get the lefty-lefty matchup, and it worked out with Bryce Turang grounding out and stuff, but always interesting to see a 20-year-old with like a sub-300 OBP draw the old intentional pass there. So, look, it's great that Churio's been fun. Ortiz has been good. You mentioned a couple of the other contributors, Blake Perkins and things like that. The story with the Blue Jays, as you kind of alluded to, has been, well, your top guys haven't hit like top guys. So as much as we can acknowledge and appreciate these contributions from everywhere on the hitting side for the Brewers, how much of how this team feels offensively comes down to Christian Yelich looking like 2019 Christian Yelich again this year?
It's a good part of it, but I think something that took the pressure off of Yelich was the development of William Contreras as a clear part of the order threat. And this is a guy that hasn't really taken more than like a day off all season. So I'm curious to see how he holds up physically with the wear and tear. I mean, they brought in Gary Sanchez to be sort of a backup catcher DH type. And even in his part-time role, he's been really effective. And I've been kind of amazed watching Gary Sanchez. The defense is not nearly as bad as Yankees fans led us to believe over the years. Gary Sanchez is actually at least an average defensive catcher, maybe even above average in some facets. I think it's one of those things where if you're susceptible to pass balls, everybody sees a pass ball.
Right.
So it looks like you're a lot worse than you really are. But I think taking some of the pressure off of Yelich, having a few other guys step up, and adding, you know, Rhys Hoskins in free agency, he's also had a stint on the IL. That gives them more thump. That gives them one more really credible bat in the lineup every day. So they're less dependent on Yelich. And I think that just makes things a lot better for them as they try and get back to the postseason and possibly make a deeper run this year.
I wonder, too, with Yankees fans and Sanchez, like, you know, for as much as we can quantify it, Sanchez is a little below average defensively, but not like crazy. But Jose Trevino is like one of the very best defensive catchers blocking and frame. We saw him steal some brutal ones over the last couple of days as well. So I wonder if that's a part of it as well. You mentioned Hoskins as an addition there. Obviously, 10 home runs. Really fun moment with the Phillies, a really fun series, really getting the big home run in that game, the play at the plate. This team seems to, and maybe this is one of those things that like you don't call it in the air. You only recognize it when a team's winning, because if the team wasn't winning, it wouldn't be there. But it does seem like, you know, the Pat Murphy change, you add a guy like Rhys Hoskins, some of the young energy here. It seems like a pretty fun clubhouse dynamic. I know you're not in that clubhouse every day, but like that fun element of this team, is that a fair read on it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's a good mix of experienced players that aren't necessarily so old that they're on a different page than the young guys, right? I mean, Willy Adames being more of like a late 20s guy instead of a 35-year-old makes a pretty big difference, because I think he can relate to those young players really well. I think there's a lot of respect for what Contreras is doing behind the plate. You know, Yelich's track record, I think, goes a long way. I don't know if he's the most boisterous guy, but I think he's pretty even keeled all the time. I think that's good for vibes as well. When things aren't going well, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that ever panics. It's good to have that. Even Rhys Hoskins as a new addition, the very first series of the year, they got into a dust up with the Mets over a slide at second base. And just seeing that they have that sort of toughness, they seem to have each other's backs in situations like that. They do present a team that has well above average vibes and leadership internally.
So, okay. So that is an important part. And, you know, you're always going to need that. Again, it wouldn't be happening, or it wouldn't be as noticeable if they weren't winning a ton of baseball games, I don't think. That's a really rebuilding only thing. Hey, we got good vibes, but we're losing a bunch of games. This team has won a bunch of games because the offense has been, you know, top five or six in the league in scoring runs. They're the fastest team in the league, arguably. They are one of the best defending teams in the league, and they've got a really strong bullpen. If there's a question mark about this team's ability to sustain and what it looks like moving forward, it's in the starting rotation. They have an entire rotation worth of guys on the IL. We got to see Colin Ray yesterday, even though the stuff isn't all that crazy. He can obviously pitch and shut down a lineup like the Blue Jays. It sounds like we're going to see Carlos F. Rodriguez debut tonight. What should we be expecting from Rodriguez? I've done my preliminary scout on him, but you'd know a little better as a prospect guy and a Brewers guy.
Yeah, so Carlos F. Rodriguez is a lot like what you saw last night from Colin Ray, by all descriptions, right? It's a kitchen sink sort of approach. It's a hide my fastballs, but have multiple fastballs to make them play up, even though they're not necessarily great pitches by velocity or ride or the characteristics that make fastballs generally unhittable. I think that's sort of a secret sauce for the Brewers organization, is that they have guys that have multiple fastballs pretty consistently. And we saw Colin Ray last night, right? It's sinker, cutter. The sweeper is actually a good pitch. The four-seamer, the splitter, the curveball. Those things all interact in a way that just makes him harder to hit than he should be. So when you look at a leaderboard and you see, you know, ERA alongside XERA or Sierra, oftentimes those Brewer starters are overperforming. I don't think it's fluky. Like, for a while when those metrics were new, it's easy to look at those things and say, oh, they're just getting lucky. They're getting lucky on balls in play. But we also know now, too, if you put a good defense behind a pitching staff like that, you can turn more balls in play into outs. And that's a skill as well. And that's something the Brewers have done pretty consistently over the last half decade or so, is they tend to have great defenders up the middle. And I think that helps the pitching staff play up. Now, the other part of the secret, though, too, is relying less on their starters. Most of their starters pitch 4 or 5 innings a night. It's a shorter outing, generally speaking. They throw Jared Koenig sometimes as an opener. That kind of helps set up matchups the way they want. They have good bullpen depth. Some of their short relievers, some relative no-name guys, are putting up fantastic seasons. I mean, Enoli Paredes comes in May, and no one can score runs on him. It's just amazing. This is a guy you got for basically nothing out of the Astros organization, right? So I think some of it is just looking under every stone, finding players, maximizing their skills. And there's a handful of other organizations that do this really well. But I feel like in the broader conversation, the Brewers don't come up as often as, you know, the Dodgers, the Astros, and the Rays as a team that really gets the most out of its players.
Yeah, and they really have. And this is how, again, you look at who the best teams in the league are and how they got there, how they built that. You know, the Brewers, yeah, they missed the playoffs in 2022, but they made the playoffs in 5 of the last 6 years. They're well ahead in the division this year. Despite being a competitive, like, win now team for the last 7 years or so, they still have a top 5 farm system, and they're not all that expensive. Like, this is, you know, the Dodgers are the Dodgers and they spend a ton. The Yankees are the Yankees and they spend a ton. Those teams have been able to be competitive and maintain good farm systems and things like that. The Brewers have also done it on a budget, which is, you know, probably more impressive than that. So let's talk about how they shape up next to those teams, because and we could do I had planned to ask you about Tobias Myers, but the answer is going to be the exact same as Colin Ray or Carlos F. Rodriguez. Hey, here are 6 pitches. None of them are all that great, but you're going to be off balance. And then we've got a great defense behind you. So we saw the Yankees against the Dodgers on the weekend and on Sunday Night Baseball. And I was watching that and I kind of got the feeling of like, man, these are really the 2 best teams I've seen play this year. And I know the Jays have seen the Orioles. The Orioles have been very good and they've kind of dominated the AL East. The Phillies have a really strong record, and we got a close eye on them in the London games against the Mets there. You guys just saw them as well. And then the Brewers and Guardians and teams like that are pretty good record-wise out of weaker divisions. Where do you see the top of Major League Baseball right now in terms of, like, how big is that first tier and you know, how meaty is that second tier if we're going to draw lines like that?
Yeah, I think you could put the Yankees, Dodgers, and Phillies probably confidently in that tier together. I think over the years, the Phillies did a good job adding high-quality relievers, maybe guys that don't have the best command, but they certainly have good stuff. And then, of course, that rotation, like we talked about in passing a little earlier, that's a great rotation when everybody's healthy, and everyone so far is healthy. And they're getting a lot of mileage out of Ranger Suarez and Christopher Sanchez, which sort of adds another layer. You expect the Phillies to maybe tick up a little bit in terms of their run production, but they can do damage. They don't strike out that much. So I think they're right up there with the Yankees and Dodgers. I think you can make a strong case for the Orioles as well. I think the only thing that would hold me back from saying they're a surefire top-tier team right now is they're starting to get pretty dinged up in their rotation. I do think they have a similar organizational philosophy to the Brewers in that they have the ability to take back-end starters and make them better. And that makes a huge difference when you can take someone that would be, you know, 5 ERA pitcher and be basically unusable in the back of the rotation, shave a run off their ERA, take a little wear and tear off the bullpen by getting through the lineup 2.5 times. That makes a pretty big difference. So for me, I'm just looking at this Orioles team and wondering, are they going to go ahead and take one of their extra position players and turn that into one more starter? I think it's because I'm worried about one of Kyle Bradish or Grayson Rodriguez breaking, right? Between Burns, Bradish, and Rodriguez, if you told me all 3 are healthy, yes, they're a tier one team. But Bradish had that elbow issue to begin the season. Grayson Rodriguez had a lot of difficulty staying healthy throughout his time in that organization. I think they become extremely vulnerable if they lose one of those three guys relative to the other elite teams.
So, and that makes sense. And I should probably have the Phillies in that top tier. We look at some of the other division leaders. You know, the Guardians have been very, very good in a division that's maybe been better than we expected in the AL Central. The Royals have been a lot of fun. They're coming back down to earth now, but they've been fun. The Twins were a playoff team last year and are hanging a little above 500. The Mariners have been good in a surprisingly poor AL West. And then there are the Brewers, who are already seven games up on everyone in the NL Central. Not to kind of bunch all the division leaders together, but would that make up kind of like a meaty, I guess, if we're putting Baltimore in kind of their own second tier there, like a meaty third tier there, and would you have the Brewers toward the top of that?
Yeah, I think I'd put them near the top of that right now because they've already weathered a pretty significant number of injuries and have still turned out a very good start. The team that's a little bit of a mystery for me is Atlanta. I mean, losing Acuna is huge. I know they won the World Series the last time he suffered a torn ACL, which is just a horrible thing to remember, but they did put that together. But they have not been the same lineup. They were not the same team even before that injury. Matt Olson was not the guy we saw a year ago. Ozzie Albies still kind of lagging behind his typical production. Austin Riley's been a shell of himself. Their pitching has been a lot better, even with the Strider injury. So I think that's the one surprise of Atlanta that still makes them dangerous, even when the bats aren't going. But if they can't make adjustments to this lineup and get the usual suspects hitting the way they can, I think they're kind of more of a mid-pack playoff team than the team to be feared that they have been for these last couple of seasons, which is really... it's really disappointing because I believed in all those guys. I mean, I think Matt Olson has bounced back potential. I think Austin Riley has bounced back potential, but it's a little bit like some of the struggling Jays bats where I can't quite pinpoint what exactly the problem is with those guys.
Yeah, and Sean Murphy as well. You know, a catcher turns 30. Is it wear and tear stuff? Is it bad luck? That's a tough one to diagnose there, even if you believe in a couple of those players turning it around. All right, Derek. Eric Thames is going to be on the show with us a little later. You're a Brewers guy. He was chugging beers at the game yesterday. Any fond Brewers memories of his time there?
Yeah, his first season in Milwaukee, he walked off the Padres, and I think it became a regular celebration, but he was swarmed to home plate, and his jersey was just shredded off of him by his teammates. I mean, I think half of it was him. He just flexed, and like it started to tear, and they just pulled it off for him. But that sort of became an iconic celebration for that team that year. He was a fun player to have in Milwaukee. He had a nice run coming out of the KBO. It was 31 home runs that first season back in 2017. So, yeah, I mean, since you have him on, have him send me his workout routine. It might have to like water it down at first so I don't hurt myself, but I would love to know like what he's doing because I got to get in the gym and follow suit.
Yeah, I think you're going to have to heavily water it down. No offense. He was always huge and is only getting huger. Quickly before we let you go, Derek, I know you guys talk a lot of fantasy on Rates and Barrel. The White Sox are an obvious one, maybe the Rockies on the road, but who are the teams that you're targeting as like, hey, this is not automatic. Like if Blake Murphy is starting, you're not going to start a guy, but who are the teams that are pretty safe? Like, hey, I'm streaming against this team every opportunity I can.
Yeah. For me, I'm like on the WRC plus team leaderboards all the time and looking at the right, very bottom. White Sox, easy. Rockies, even in Colorado, maybe now that the weather's warmer, I'd be a little more careful throwing guys at altitude. Marlins, I'll throw guys against them anywhere. Pirates, a little more careful with the Nationals. They're bottom five by WRC plus. They steal a lot of bases. They don't strike out a lot. So you got to be a little more careful about some of your kitchen sink guys against them, maybe getting into some trouble and having a lot of traffic. The Tigers are a team I'm still picking on. The A's, they're better than we expected, but they're still not good. They got a 26.3% strikeout rate. We want strikeouts. So stream against the A's and don't feel bad about it. I think the Angels are probably at the upper end of that group that I look at them, and without Trout especially, I have very little respect for the lineup they're putting on the field right now. So no hesitation in throwing most of my starters against any of those teams at this point.
This is, I guess, the one nice thing about the league offensive environment being so poor with a 699 OPS is it's always good eating, streaming, starting pitchers. Derek Van Riper of The Athletic, Rates and Barrels. Thanks so much for taking the time out, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Blake.
Derek Van Riper of The Athletic, Rates and Barrels with Trevor May, who we had on the show last week, and our pal Eno Saris, who gutted through a sore throat in their latest episode, was just hammering the tea. That's when you can have a podcast co-host fight through illness like that for you. That's when you know it's a special team. That's when you know it could be a special year for a podcast. We'll see if the Jays could turn this around over the rest of the series, get back up to 500, and see if they can turn this into a special year. Shai Davidi was at the game last night and wrote about kind of this in the loss, a couple good quotes from George Springer and John Schneider about where this team is and where they need to go. We're looking at about 5 weeks to the All-Star break. Even if things went poorly over the next couple weeks, we probably don't expect the Jays to make any sort of decision on direction until we get to that point. So, yeah, big 5 weeks ahead. Very difficult schedule. Continues tonight with the with more of this Brewers team. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Shai Davidi will join us. We'll talk more about Alek Manoah and the surgery and rehab he has ahead. And then Eric Thames will join us a little later in the show.
Breaking down the top stories in hockey and Elliot Friedman every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays lose 3-1 last night in Milwaukee. Shai Davidi was there. Shai Davidi just doing work. Talking to Alek Manoah about the week that was between his initial elbow thing and finding out that he's headed for surgery. We'll talk more about that. But you were at the game last night, Shai. And yeah, John Schneider said it sucks that this was the most entertaining part of the game. But how much were you considering the idea of like, hey, what I'm writing off this game is just going to be related to Chris Bassett's quest to get this bat down from the netting?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, that's an interesting sidebar. I think from a bigger picture, like, and it's kind of funny, right? Like, you get 2 days in a row where you've got this really weird moment that you rarely see. Like, the obviously Sunday, the Yusei Kikuchi collision with Tyler Soderstrom, and really a made in Oakland only moment because they just can be bothered to put railing up at any point over the last 2 decades when every other team in Major League Baseball did. And then yesterday, like, yeah, the knob breaking through the meshing and hooking through there and getting stuck. But the bigger picture, it's a really interesting transitionary game, right? So the Blue Jays went through this period where they had a soft spot in their schedule. They got themselves level, or close to level, and now they've got a real opportunity where they're, okay, this is realistic, but now they've got to play well against the good teams. And so that was the beginning of a tough stretch. Colin Ray was pretty good last night. And, you know, Jose Barrios really made a couple mistakes with the slurve, and that's their ball game. So obviously there is that sort of viral funny moment, but bigger picture, I thought there's a little bit more intrigue there as well.
Yeah. If things were going a little worse, then you'd say, yeah, well, if you can't be good, be entertaining the last 2 days. Right. And maybe that ends up being the piece, but yes, I thought your piece really kind of nailed it. There were some great quotes from George Springer as well saying, you know, we wouldn't say we're out of the hole, but we've been playing better and think we can continue to play better, et cetera. Is that kind of where the team's attitude is? Like, that 9-4 stretch happened, and it included a pretty good split against the Orioles, who, by the way, just swept the Rays 4-4 and have destroyed the entire AL East all year. So, you know, 2 splits with the Orioles maybe looks a little better right now. But is that kind of the attitude? Mm-hmm. Hey, 9-4, we got back almost where we'd hoped to be back at this point. And now's the time where, like, we're really going to find out who we are.
I still think there's recognition that they they're not out of the woods at all. Mm-hmm. But I think just the degree of conversation or some of the emotion around this team, it's been very strange, right? Like, and for good reason, they haven't played well. So let's acknowledge that. But I think some of the conversations, like, this team is a walking disaster. I think that if you look within the landscape of Major League Baseball, I mean, generally, there is a lot of mid, right? There are 11 mm-hmm. teams who are at 500 or better. So it's like a third. Like, it's a very top-heavy league. And then there's a lot of mediocre. And the Blue Jays right now are sort of in that mid-tier. They fancy themselves or believe that they can climb up into that top tier, but they're not there yet. And I think that's right now sort of where the Blue Jays are at. Like, okay, we haven't played well. We put ourselves in a hole. We've started to get out of it, but we've really got to turn it up now to get where we want to go.
And obviously the expanded playoff format we've seen the last couple of years informs a lot of this, right? Where, you know, if it were the one wild card system, well, the Orioles have that locked up. Like, we're like, sure, you could theoretically catch up, but you're talking about 11 and a half games there. Now we've got three, and yeah, the Royals kind of have a hold on one right now, but I think a lot of people look at the Royals and say, hey, this is a fun story. They'll probably come back down to earth a little bit. So there are still two spots up for grabs. How much of that, you know, I guess the conversation of the team, and we can't speak for everyone, but it does seem a little bit like the discourse around what a season is like and where, you know, where you need to be has changed a little bit. Now, obviously, like the Jays were not, the expectation this year was not sneak into the wild card and then hope something happens in the playoff. The goal should have been to compete for the division, be up there with the Yankees and the Orioles. But when we talk about, you know, when we make it binary, playoffs or non-playoffs, it is way different these last couple of years.
Oh, for sure. And I can think back to the one wild card times and the kind of conversations you would have with front offices. And at that point, the mindset was you didn't want to be in 10 to 20 in terms of teams in the major leagues, right? That murky middle, that was considered the worst place to be because you wanted to be either really good or building to be good. But if you're stuck in that gray zone, you know, you're not really competing, you're not picking high in the draft, you're not really advancing any sort of program. Whereas now in the 3-1 wild card world, like you have to be really bad to completely fall off, fall out of the race. Like you have to be determinedly bad. You have to be White Sox Athletics bad to be out of the race. And that changes a lot of the calculations at this time of year, because if you've got a chance to just hang in there a little bit, you, to some degree, you owe it to your fans to try and do that. But at the same time, you kind of get in the situation where, are you really building towards something more significant? And are you hurting yourself from a longer term perspective? And how do you balance sort of your short term aspirations where, yeah, you can sneak in and maybe you can become the Arizona Diamondbacks or something, versus do you suffer for a bit and try to maybe become like the Baltimore Orioles? So I think that in some ways, this is a bit more of a more complicated time for front offices, because the decision making and the risk reward equation is vastly different from where it was, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
And you said it, like there are only five teams right now who are six games out of a playoff spot. That's it in the entire major leagues. And we're like 70 games in almost at this point. So only five teams that if the trade deadline were today, you'd be like, yep, those are 100% sellers. Everyone else might be like, ah, I don't really know. So from that respect, and you just laid out a good case of like, it puts those teams that are in the middle into a difficult risk reward win versus win now versus win later trade-off. Obviously, these 5 weeks between now and the All-Star game are very pivotal for the Blue Jays in terms of the standings and things like that. How much do you think things could still swing from the perspective of this front office's decision-making?
I think it's all on what lies ahead, right? Because, look, the Blue Jays have seven expiring contracts on the roster right now, including Yusei Kikuchi and Jimmy Garcia and Danny Jansen. And those three guys in particular, but some others as well, could bring you back some real value at the trade deadline. And if this team, and my sense is that if the Blue Jays did fall out of it, their lean would be, or their intent would be, to move some expiring assets and then reset around the remaining group for 2025 to take another kick at it there. You've got to get something for that, because you'd also be in a seller's market because there's so few teams that are selling that you should be able to do pretty well. At the same time, the Blue Jays don't want to be that. They want to be one of the teams trying to buy. And so I think that the Blue Jays could operate on sort of parallel tracks or prepare, and they probably will, unless something definitively happens that sends them on one path or the other. Just be prepared to go both different routes as you get up to July 30th, and then give the team as much time as you can before you pick a course.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. Tough decisions ahead, but the Jays can dictate some of it with their play over these next 5 weeks. So when it comes to the rest of 2024 or even 2025, a huge question mark, well, not even a question mark for 2024, Alec Manoah's done. You wrote a terrific story at sportsnet.ca. It was clear you spent a lot of time talking with Alec Manoah through what the last, you know, week or two have been like since he felt the pinch in his elbow and things like that. And yeah, you kind of went into what the decision-making process was like. What even the process, I think it was a lot of great detail just on like, hey, what is a high-stress MRI? What is the difference when you go for a second opinion down to Dr. Keith Meister and things like that? So I guess before we get into the specifics of what lies ahead, how is Alek Manoah handling all of this? You got a lot of great insight from him into, you know, where he's been at the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, it was really interesting. And I've thought about this a lot of times, but just what it is like, that process from injury to surgery and what an athlete goes through. And I just went up to Alek and I said, hey, I just want to know what that was like. And do you mind detailing kind of what you went through? And he was really generous with his time and his insights and wanting to just share that experience. And it's really remarkable because there are emotional swings, right? There are periods of time where, you know, he got little bits of or peaks or hints of optimism. And he's like, okay, well, maybe it's not that bad. And then something happens, you don't feel good. And then there's a bit of pessimism. And it's really an emotional roller coaster. And then eventually it's one doctor to another doctor, get to a specialist to make sure. And this is the person who's going to be doing the surgery. So they want to do their own testing. There's a lot of back and forth throughout that process. And so, you know, I think Alek Manoah knew, or he said that he had braced himself for the worst. There were points in times where he got to hoping for the best. And then, you know, when he finally heard the word surgery, it all sort of hit him. I guess he'd been prepared for it, but maybe not wholly prepared for it. And so at that point, the reality of where he was at had sunk in, and it was like, okay, well, I guess my season's over. And that's a lot for an athlete to reconcile.
Yeah, and it seems like he pretty quickly turned the page. I guess you don't have a lot of choice if you're going to, you know, you can obviously give yourself some grace in terms of like feeling sorry for yourself and feeling down about it. But it did seem like he turned the page pretty quickly to, you know what, I'm going to be able to use this time to make myself better, to work on my nutrition and my body and things like that. What does that tell you about, you know, where the last year plus has put Alek Manoah mentally? You know, is he... There's never a good time for this, but it does seem like he was able to flip the page quickly, at least in talking to you, and this maybe won't be linear when he actually gets into it, but into trying to see the positives out of this.
Yeah, for sure. And he acknowledged that he's going to have some ups and downs with that, and that he's just going to try to do his best to remain as positive as he can. But he knows that there are going to be days where it's going to be a grind, and he's going to have to fight through some of that negativity. But he's had to do a lot of growing up in a lot of ways over the last year and a half, right? He's faced baseball challenges that he'd never before experienced. He's had some periods in college where he didn't perform, he struggled, he had to do some soul searching and come back. But it's obviously different when you're doing that at the major league level. That's a completely different beast there. So just in talking to him over the past year and a half, you get a sense that this is someone who's really had to, I don't want to use grow up, but just mature a little bit more and just understand that there are times in your life where you're going to face challenges and how you meet them, as much as from a process perspective, as opposed to just a results perspective, is really important in terms of, are you going to be able to get through that? And so he's going to apply all of that to what lies ahead for him. And the other piece is that he does believe that he's got a chance to come back with his arm in a much better shape. You know, the intent is to get the ligament replacement with the internal brace. The early impressions are that extends the life of an elbow. This should, in theory, carry him throughout the rest of his career. And if he's able to do that and he's got his elbow strong and combine that with all the other elements that he implemented over this past offseason, you know, he feels very bullish about what his future is. And, you know, that's obviously very, very important for the Blue Jays as well.
Yeah, for anyone who didn't read it or isn't aware, there's the standard Tommy John. And as Dr. Keith Meister laid out in your piece, that used to be, hey, that's you're good for 15 years. Like the UCL replacement is good to go. That'll last you most of your career. But now, as guys throw even harder and spin the ball even more, that timeline has gone to more, you know, 7, 8, 9 years. We've seen a lot more guys get a second Tommy John and things like that. So this hybrid surgery will replace the UCL and anchor it in place with what's called an internal brace suture. So that sounds like a positive. You know, it's something that Alek Manoah won't have to come back on the mound and, you know, worry about in the short term. It does mean, though, you use the phrase in your piece, Shai, out well into next year. Do we have a sense of, you know, how, like, okay, a standard Tommy John is maybe 12 months-ish. The, like, Hyunjin Ryu came back a little on the shorter end, but his was only a partial Tommy John. We've seen guys on, like, the 16-month end of that. Are we going to know that until, like, well into the rehab process?
We won't, okay. Right? Because there are plans, and always it's all about how you respond. And some guys respond really well. And, you know, 12 months is, in a lot of ways, the best case. And so let's say it's 12 months. You're talking about he's having the surgery June 17th. So you're talking middle of the season next year. And that's on the best side. But if it's 13, 14 months, then, you know, July, August, maybe September, that's really well into the season. And so the Blue Jays will have to, in a sense, go into next year with Alek Manoah not being factored into their plans. And then if he does end up in their plans, that being a pleasant surprise. And it's very similar. You mentioned Hyunjin Ryu, and it was very similar to Hyunjin's return last year, where, you know, the Blue Jays really looked at him as, if he pitched that season, being found money. And then as he was progressing along in his rehab, it was clear that he was going to be able to factor for them. And memory serves, he returned right at the beginning of August and ended up being, in a sense, a trade deadline addition for them, as a way to kind of look at it. And so maybe that's the pathway for Alek Manoah next year. But until he's into that rehab and until he's been throwing, you know, the plan is to start throwing around December. Until he starts throwing and is able to really start making some progress and seeing where, how the arm responds and how the body responds, there won't be really any way to gauge that.
So, Shai, that's obviously, you know, what the pitching depth looks like next year is a question that'll depend on Yusei Kikuchi's free agency, Yariel Rodriguez's progression, Adam Matko, things like that. With respect to the rest of this year, now that we, it's official, Alek Manoah is not coming back. It's as bad as people feared. Have you gotten a sense of if this team is exploring its options for that fifth starter spot, or if we are looking at probably a Bowden Francis plus Yariel Rodriguez in some form of tag team for the imminent future here?
Yeah, I mean, they're looking externally, but there isn't a ton of pitching available, so I don't see that anything being imminent there. And so right now the focus is on building up Yariel Rodriguez and having him, in a sense, take a prime role there, whether he's starting or there is some sort of piggyback with Bowden Francis, something along those lines. That right now seems to be what they're working towards. And so Yariel Rodriguez has a rehab outing with Buffalo tonight. The Blue Jays are hoping he's around 70, 75 pitches in that. And potentially his next time could be with the Blue Jays after that. But a lot of that will depend on how he's feeling out of this. And in just talking to some people, this is the second time he's had a back issue flare up, back lat issue kind of flare up for him this year. The Blue Jays want to be super careful with that because it's been twice right now. They obviously don't want it to be a third time. So they want to make sure he's physically ready to go when he does, but they do see him as a starter next year. They're going to need him, in a sense, to be a starter next year. So they'd like to try to build him up in that way. The innings cap for him is a bit less of a concern right now because of the stops and starts this year, that he probably has the innings left to take on that role. But the other piece to this too is that, you know, Ricky Tiedemann, if all things had been equal there, you know, this would have been Ricky Tiedemann's time. And Tiedemann suffered the elbow injury there too. And so he's still building up and he should be getting into a minor league game or rehab game in the next little while. but his progression is sort of a factor that's off in the distance. The primary piece right now is probably Yariel Rodriguez. And the Blue Jays do want to get to something that's relatively stable there, because it's been okay the past two times. It hasn't really cost them in terms of bullpen usage, but there's going to be a point in time where that spot comes up and the Blue Jays are prepared for a full bullpen day.
Shai, maybe this is kind of a medium-term question. It's something for later in the year, or maybe even 2025. You wrote a terrific profile on Adam Mackle last year, right as things kind of started to turn around for him after a shakier start to that season. He has been very good for Double A New Hampshire this year, especially over his last six starts or so. He's now, you know, pitching on a more starter's load, where it's, you know, closer to every fifth day and a full pitch count and things like that. Not quite where he was at the start of the season. How enticed could the Blue Jays be to maybe not rush him to the majors, but make that promotion to AAA a little earlier than they expected to make sure that he's ready? You know, if there is one more injury, or I don't know, if he just keeps progressing the way he's progressed this year.
Well, if you kind of think about it, once you factor in the injuries to Tiedemann, the season-ending surgeries for Brandon Barriera, Lannon Marudis, in the Blue Jays, Mackle's become the Blue Jays' best pitching prospect, right? This might have been an opportunity for Chad Dallas, who's at AAA Buffalo, who had a lot of momentum built up last year in New Hampshire, and hit a bit of a bump this year. He's an interesting guy too. He's just hasn't had the greatest of starts to his season. Mackle has really emerged, and you know, people are noticing in the front office. I think there's the balance there where he is still relatively young. He last year was one of the first seasons where he was really healthy start to finish. The Blue Jays want to make sure they can build that progressively and constructively, as opposed to just zipping him through and maybe having some sort of setback there. So I think that'll be a piece of the factor, but he's definitely on the radar for a promotion to AAA. And really, if you're a Double A and you're performing, you know, that you're at a point where you'll start getting some potential big league consideration too. And I'm not saying that that's imminent by any stretch of the imagination, but he's starting to push himself into those types of discussions. So he's definitely someone to keep an eye on, and someone who's done a lot of work to get himself to this point and deserves a lot of credit for that.
And nice for the organization to have a pitching development win when a lot of their top prospects are out hurt. So, the strikeout rate, striking out almost 12 per 9 at AA over 11 starts there, and the walk rates come down. So continue to keep an eye on Adam Mackle. Shai, before we let you go, I know that this has been talked about, you know, you wrote about it and you've tweeted about it already, but I haven't talked to you since Kevin Biggio was designated for assignment to make room for Spencer Horwitz. Can you give us a little bit of insight into why that was the particular decision over, say, a Daniel Vogelbach, or, you know, the Ernie Clement one is almost certainly for the defensive and pinch running value there. But it did seem to catch a lot of us off guard that the choice was Kevin Biggio there.
Yeah. So essentially it just came down to, he wasn't playing very much. And if you're going to treat Spencer Horwitz as a second baseman, which is what the Blue Jays have done at this point, well, he sort of becomes a redundancy at that point where, okay, Ernie Clement can give you some shortstop, he can give you some third, he can give you some second. And you didn't maybe need an extra outfielder now that David Schneider has essentially become your fourth outfielder in a way. And so the Blue Jays felt that, you know, when you combine that, how he might be used, they weren't going to be able to get time from him, because they really want to give Spencer Horwitz a bit of run here. And so when you think about the role that Daniel Vogelbach is in, and it's to, you know, pinch hit in certain specific occasions, and then DH against specific types of opponents, there was a specific vision for the usage there. Whereas with Kevin Biggio at that point, well, you know, you've got Ernie Clement doing some of the things, you got Spencer Horwitz doing some things, you got Davis Schneider doing some of the things, and, you know, you just want him to come in and pinch run on occasion. And so it was a very difficult one. I think, you know, Kevin Biggio was very much loved in that clubhouse. There were a lot of players that he was close with that came up the ladder with him. So it was an emotional one for a lot of reasons. But I think those are the reasons why the Blue Jays landed where they did with him.
All right. Well, thanks, Shad. That makes sense. We'll see where this lands in terms of a trade in the coming days, or if they expose him to waivers. And I'd assume if Nico Goodrum is getting picked up off of waivers still, Kevin Biggio will get picked up off of waivers by someone. Shy, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Enjoy the rest of Milwaukee.
Yeah, appreciate it. Have a good one, Blake.
Shai Davidi of Sportsnet, of Sportsnet.ca. Make sure you go read that Alek Manoah piece that we were discussing. Shai got a lot of good detail in there on this procedure and the rehab from it, as well as Alek Manoah's, the day-to-day of waiting to find out if you're going to need surgery, and then also the psyche there. A lot of really great work from Shai on this road trip. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Eric Thames, who is a former Blue Jay and a former Brewer. We're also going to give away some tickets to the Stanley Cup Final in Edmonton and a Shania Twain concert that will precede that. You can get more details on that as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The most opinionated Maple Leaf show out there. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That is Holy Diver by Dio, which means it must be time for our next guest, former Toronto Blue Jay, former Milwaukee Brewer, and drinker of a very large beer at the game yesterday. It's Eric Thames, KBO legend. Eric, what's up, man? Thank you for doing this.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Man, it's been a minute. I don't know if you remember. When you were in Korea, I did a piece for you that no longer exists because Vice Sports shut down all their stuff. But it's nice to talk to you again. Nice to catch up. How was the game yesterday?
Well, it depends if you're a Brewer fan or a Jays fan. But there were definitely some home runs, so that makes me happy. So I was entertained, but I'm still a little disappointed in myself with that beer chug. So it was a hard sleep last night.
Well, the nice thing about something like that, Eric, is that today's a new day. You get another chance to chug a beer if you so choose. So there you go, man. You can do it. Want to talk to you, about a lot of stuff, but your time with the Blue Jays first, since this is a Toronto show, obviously drafted back in 2008, came up in 2011. What do you remember best about your time with the Jays? I know you weren't here for a ton of time, but yeah, what stands out to you looking back on that time?
I mean, honestly, it broke my heart when I was traded away to Seattle because I love the city of Toronto. There's so many restaurants I love there. My routine was there. But I just love being around the guys, and baseball's a little different back then because I feel like every baseball team now in the big leagues, everybody's like 25 and under. Like if you're over 30, that's like a rare thing. But my team back then, like everybody was like 35, you know, playing with like Casey Jansen and like John McDonald and Aaron Hill and a lot of like veterans. So, you know, my game, I learned a lot from being around those older guys. So like that definitely was a huge part of my game.
You also came up, you came up around age 24. You came up kind of at the same time as Travis Snyder, and there was that, you know, obviously competition is healthy in some sense, but you guys were kind of trading playing time back and forth and things like that. Looking back on it, do you think that slowed down a little bit your ability to kind of get your footing in the majors? You know, just the fact that and I've talked to Travis about this before too, the kind of like, well, looking over your shoulder for playing time and that level of pressure other than just doing your best maybe.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, that's just a part of the game, you know. It's not often you're a guy like Bryce Harper where it's like you're in the league and boom, it's your job forever, you know. But, you know, Travis obviously is a great player, he's a great prospect, so that obviously fueled my fire as well to try to, okay, I have to outwork this guy to get playing time, and for him the same way. I mean, our careers were a little different, but I think the competition was a little healthy and we definitely pushed each other.
When it comes to that era of the Blue Jays, obviously the Jays just released their City Connect and it's not a reference to the old black one. Some people wanted that. You still like the look of those black jerseys and that particular hat that you guys had at that time?
You know, I love the blue. I love the throwback when they went back to it. I just love that color. The city loves it. It's a good throwback to the World Series championship days. But I'm just nostalgic with the black because I came up with the black. So, and you almost never see that anymore. Like every Jays game, like I see on TV or anything, it's like, it's all blue. It's like, no, I want to see some of those black jerseys. That was when the good days for me. So,
yeah.
So that's where I stand on it.
Yeah, we got to bring back the fighting necklaces too. Like I know you've joked about that on Instagram before. We got to have our ions more, I don't know, magnetized or charged or whatever those things. I used to wear them all the time for slow pitch too, as if a slow pitch player would need those fighting necklaces.
Yeah, what was that test where they would like have you stand up, put your arm out, and they like push your arm down and like your balance is better? Whatever that was, but I mean, fighting next were everywhere. Everybody had one. It was so cool.
Oh, man, it was a good part of the look. Okay, so, you know, you're with the Jays. You got traded. You bounced around a little bit. And then you ultimately decide for 2014 to make the move to the Korean League. I know you played in the Venezuelan League as well. But for anyone who doesn't remember, you go and you make the jump to Korea. How big was that change, like lifestyle-wise? What do you remember about that? Those initial kind of months playing in the Korean League?
Yeah, it was wild. Like I thought my time playing was done, and I was already looking to go back to school and all this stuff. And they just randomly called my agent. And I was like, okay, you know what? Whatever. Let's try it, see what happens. And it was just like the biggest learning experience. Like food. Like, cause I couldn't speak the language at all, so I had to like learn really fast how to like speak and order basic things. And I mean, it was a nightmare the first year, but once I got my feet rolling a little bit and got used to it, it was just the most fun I've ever had because I played every day. Like, they're flying you over there and paying you for you to play. There's no worrying about playing time or, like the Snyder thing. Like you're looking over your shoulder, you know, when you're 0-for-8, you know, but, like, there it's okay, let's go, hammer it out. So that was great for me. That, like, made me into the player that, you know, I became.
So other than the, you know, the language barrier and ordering food, I'm sure you learned the term bulgogi really quickly and kind of went with it from there. What were some of the other biggest challenges with, you know, making that move over there?
Learning all the pitchers. I can't just say, oh, who's that throwing? Oh, yeah, I faced like last year, 2 weeks ago, whatever. But it's like, okay, who's this guy? Okay, what does he throw? And then getting actually like used to the movement and like seeing a lot of fork balls and splitters, because like in the big leagues, at least back then, not a lot of guys threw like a good splitter, but over there that's what all those guys throw. So getting used to like how I'm adjust my swing, you know, things like that.
So it obviously went well enough that Chang Wan gave you honorary citizenship. I saw it the other year. You know, won an MVP, won a home run title, a couple gold gloves, couple all stars, etc. What do you think clicked for you over there? Like, obviously the power was always there in your profile a little bit, but you became kind of an average hitter, a base stealer, a gold glover. A lot opened up for you performance-wise.
Yeah, I would say my mind relaxed. Like, it was, like I said earlier, like being able to play every day and not worry about, oh, man, if I don't get a hit here, then I'll be pinch hitting tomorrow, or I'll be a few back in AAA or something like that. But I was able to know, okay, look, I'm going to be here the whole year. So I'm going to really learn how to hit these guys, like shorten my swing up, go have a flatter swing, not try to drive the ball, like actually just let the ball kind of drive itself off the bat. But things like that, like having my routine every single day. And I really learned the importance of that, having a routine. Everybody needs a routine every day. You get up at 10 o'clock every day, or 9 or whatever you do. You read your book, you get your coffee, get your lunch, go to the field, do your routine. So really establishing that helped me a ton. So, yeah.
So that's great. And obviously the results are the results. I do. And you and I talked about this way back when you were still in Korea, but for the audience who maybe didn't read that piece, the 40 stolen bases kind of came out of nowhere, like the power opening up, the hitting for more average, the OBP and stuff. You can see all that. And then boom, out of nowhere, a guy who, you know, obviously you're very well known for being a large jack dude. You also steal 40 bases. I know you had attributed that a little bit to the first base coach you had there. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of your game opening up?
Yeah, just learning. I mean, there's a lot of players, even the big leagues now, that aren't particularly fast, but they know when to pick their moments. And I just learned like when to pick my moments. I'm not going to go every time. I'm not like a Bryce Turing or a Bo Bichette or something like that. I'm just out there. Okay. Like, let me just, I know he's focusing on the hitter behind me. He's going to throw a split in the dirt or a curveball and what you out of the hand and then bam, it's gone. And slide head first. The guy was like, you always slide head first because you always be safe. Because, like, you know, when you slide feet first, like, yeah, like some guys can get away with it. But like, for me, like, I needed that little extra split second. So that helped me a ton.
Yeah, you get the little oven mitt on, so you get an extra inch on your slide. And things.
Yeah, yeah. That's a play, especially now the pizza boxes, those bases, like, that's a play. It's real stuff.
Yeah. Cool. So that was Korea. And I do want to talk about when you came back to the majors. But how did Korea, playing in Korea, compare to you? You went to Japan a couple years later. I know that stint was injury shortened. But, you know, playing in those two places where baseball is obviously huge and the cultures are more similar than they are to here, but obviously some stark differences between Korean baseball and Japanese baseball.
Oh, it was a huge difference. I mean, it's night and day. I know my time there was very limited because I tore my Achilles first game in the big league over there. It's like baseball's life, like for Korean leagues and Japanese leagues. Like the players, like they're always training. It's just it's so different from the U.S. where it's kind of like more relaxed and like the guys are really talented. But there it's more like army kind of style. Like even the training is like army style. Like there's a lot of stories about like Japanese high school. Now their rosters have like 120 kids on it. And their practices are like a boot camp. Like it's just crazy stuff. And that's just how it is. Like they take baseball very, very seriously. So it's definitely a great thing to see. And it's like it's great to see how beautiful the game is around the world and how it impacts everybody differently.
Well, it's a very cool part of your career that you've gotten to experience at Korea, Japan, Venezuela, and obviously in the United States and Canada. So you did return to the Brewers after Korea. You hit 72 home runs over a couple seasons there. When you decided to come back, what was your kind of expectation level or confidence level like that all the work you'd done in Korea would translate back to the majors the way it did?
Oh, my confidence was sky high. I knew the adjustments I made with my swing, the play over here. I didn't do anything crazy. Didn't have a crazy leg kick or big wild swing. I knew I was short, I was compact. And I knew it would play. And I knew the Brewers trusted me because they gave me that contract. And I was just ready to play stateside so my family could see me and not have to watch a game at 3 in the morning, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure that was a nice boost. And it seems like you've, you know, kept at least some roots with the Brewers organization and that city. Is that an accurate read?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's great. It's good to see you pop up every so often, like chugging a beer or something. It's always chugging a beer that makes social media. Man, how nice is it to be able to, like, do baseball games as a fan again now?
Oh, I love it. It's awesome. Like, everybody always asks me if I miss the game, and honestly, the game itself, not really. Just, like, the stress, and, you know, I'm getting older, and my body's a little banged up, but I miss, like, the team, I miss the guys, I miss just seeing all, like, the home run celebrations and, like, all the outfits they put on, the swords, and even, like, the Blue Jays have that blazer. Like, that stuff is so cool, and I miss that. Like, the team flights, and there's always pranks. Like, that's what makes baseball great, you know, that team camaraderie.
Definitely. It's a lot of fun. So I'm sure there are other things you get to do in retirement as well. And I'm going to ask you about this one, and I'm sorry I have to ask, but how much different is the lifting routine now that you don't have to play every day and you don't have to worry about, like, what is baseball functional and what isn't?
Oh, it's wild. Like, for the first, like, probably 6 months, because I haven't benched since I was, like, probably 22, I would say. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to start bench pressing. I'm going to take all the pre-workout. Like, because, you know, like, you don't want to take too much, like, caffeine when you're playing because you'll get jittery and, like, your eyes will start moving a little bit. But I'm like, okay, like, I don't have to rotate anymore. I don't have to, like, be explosive. I just want to, like, give me those beach muscles. So, yeah, so, like, especially being retired, I have so much time. So I work for, like, 3 hours, hang out, look at memes on my phone, and then go back to working out. I'm like, oh, man, I need to, like, get back to, like, hammering stuff out. But, yeah, right now I'm just enjoying it. the beach muscles are very important to me right now.
Nice. Well, it looks like it's coming along well, man. You're also, I know you're a huge metal guy, and I know even as an active player, you were trying to get in concerts and stuff like that. I'd imagine there's some extra flexibility to get in shows and festivals and things like that. What's kind of, either what do you have coming up this summer, or what's the coolest one you've been to recently?
Ooh, that's a tough one. In Vegas, there was a metal festival called Sick New World, and that was maybe like 2 months ago, 3 months ago. That was really good. Lamb of God, Perfect Circle was there. I mean, it was, there's so many. Slaughter to Prevail. I mean, it was a great show, great show. I mean, it was all day. So 12 hours, and the weather was perfect. It was just beautiful weather, good bands, metal. But yeah, when you play, it's like you just hope that, like please do like a Sunday where you're at home and a band is in town. It's like, oh my, I remember Camelot came to Toronto one time and we had a day game on Sunday to an off day on Monday and then another home game on Tuesday. So the Sunday night was open. So I saw Camelot in Toronto. I was so happy. And it's like, oh, so sometimes maybe like once a season, you'll get like a lucky show like that, but it's not always guaranteed.
Okay, so I know the other thing that you would look out for on an off night or an afternoon game or whatever is you'd show up at pro wrestling, right? Like you'd get in a Monday Night Raw or something like that. I know you've always kind of joked with the WWE promo style and stuff like that. Do you still pay any attention to it? Like, you still a fan?
I'm still a fan, but I'm more on the old nostalgia stuff now. Like, I've been going through all the Attitude Era stuff. So one thing is that Peacock or Hulu, one of the streaming services, like, plays all of it. They have all the rights to it. So I'll click by like year and just like air out all the Stone Cold stuff, all like the Rock highlights, like the WrestleManias. So yeah, so right now I'm on the nostalgia train.
Did you tune back in for the Rock's return at WrestleMania this year though?
I did. Yeah, it was him and Cena, and yeah. It was good. I mean, like, it's good to see him back in it, but I just miss all this like legit trash talk. Even though now he's like a heel, but I love that guy. I love it.
I don't know if I should reveal this because it's not a. Shawn Michaels is on the show with me tomorrow. Obviously, it's not a baseball conversation. It'll just be a wrestling conversation. But I'm geeking out a little bit for the same reasons, the nostalgia element that you're talking about there.
Dude, you're so lucky.
Yeah. You got any questions for him? I'll happily hit him with a question for you. Like, hey, do you want Eric Thames down in NXT sometime soon trying out, or what's the deal?
I'm just curious. Okay, when he goes to parties, does he do all that dancing stuff? Like, when he was younger, single, all that stuff. Was he just, like, doing all his, like, all his HBK moves? Is that what made the girls, you know, move? I want to know that because, like,
yeah, it's right in the theme song. It has to be true, right? Like, the character's just you turned up to 11. That's what they always say.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. That's great.
All right, man. I will let you go and get on with your second workout of the day or whatever here, man. Eric Thames, really appreciate you taking the time out, man.
Hey, thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Eric Thames, former Toronto Blue Jay, former Milwaukee Brewer, KBO legend, all-around good dude, and once said his wrestling name would be Chocolate Thunder. So pretty good wrestling tie-in there as well. And yeah, I don't know if I should pre-announce it just in case plans change, but Shawn Michaels is going to be on the show tomorrow, which is very, very cool. Also very cool, we're going to send some people to Game 4 of the Stanley Cup. Rogers has announced an exciting new national contest, Bring Stanley Home, to send Rogers customers and hockey fans from across Canada to the Stanley Cup Final in Edmonton. Rogers customers have the chance to win 10 VIP trips for two to attend Game 4 in Edmonton on Saturday, June 15th. The prize also includes travel and accommodation, plus premium viewing at a game day concert featuring Shania Twain outside Rogers Place. Visit rogers.com/Stanley Cup. to enter for your chance to win and for more details. Again, a VIP trip for two, Game 4 in Edmonton on Saturday, Shania Twain outside Rogers Place pregame, rogers.com/Stanley Cup. Wish that Rogers employees were eligible for that one because, yeah, Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Final would obviously be very, very cool, but great seats to a Shania Twain concert, also very, very cool. We got a couple of minutes left. We'll take a look at some texts that are in the text line. I will try to sprinkle those in throughout the week as well. As always, you can text us to 590, 590, and I'll try to leave them in a queue and not forget about them. Stuart from Vancouver asked the other day, a couple years ago, Bo would choke up after two strikes. What happened? He still does. I don't know if like physically choke up, but you know, we can see that the bat speed's a little lower in two strike counts. He does lead the league in foul balls. So when we're talking about, you know, some of that is missing your pitch before two strikes. But once he gets the two strikes, you know, there's a lot of fouling off to stay alive. Obviously the results for him haven't been there on a lot of different fronts. It's been a tough go. I don't know if specifically the two strike bat approach is the culprit, because a lot of times, obviously, he's swinging early in counts and things like that. But everything is worth examining at this point. Kevin from Charlottetown had asked the other day if a AAA addition of Kesson Hura would be a low-risk potential help for the Jays' hitting woes. Maybe, I mean, it always helps to look at pretty much anyone who's out there. You know, Harold Ramirez got DFA'd by the Rays, things like that. But if it's another first base type who doesn't have a lot of positional versatility, I don't know that that's going to move the needle a ton. They've already got more first basemen than they can find homes for. They're playing them at second base and third base, and that's pushing a second baseman to left field. I think I'd probably look for someone with a little bit more positional value there, although it is nice to see that he's having a good season at AAA. And I don't know. I'm sure we'll see him back in the he's there in Detroit system. So I'm a little surprised, actually, now that I think about it and see the numbers, that he wasn't the recall for Spencer Torkelson going down. But I guess also he just like hasn't hit well enough. I don't know. 6 home runs, 10 doubles. I don't think that's the guy. Sorry to the person who asked that question. Scott in Red Deer said, there's not much ever said about the Jays hitters pregame preparation for opposing pitchers. Other teams seem more prepared for the Jays pitchers. Why is that? I mean, Scott, honestly, the answer to this one is that we're calling that one based on results. We're calling a 3 that gets made a good shot and a 3 that misses a bad shot, even if it's the same shot. The reason that it seems like other teams are better prepared for the Jays pitchers than the Jays are for them is because the Jays have been out hit by their opponents. It's not, I mean, no team is opening up their process to us. But a lot of times the text and the text line are complaining that the Jays get too much information. There's too much scouting reporter. They're too focused on this from that pitcher, et cetera. I think sometimes when things are going poorly, we have a tendency to pick out not a narrative, but an explanation that makes sense to us, which is fine. Some of them are going to be correct. But in a case like this, you know, we have some text in the text line saying they're overprepared. There's too much information. They're not playing to their strengths. They're playing too much to the opposing pitcher. Or we have some like this that, hey, they're not prepared enough. They're not focused enough in on the other team's pitcher. It's probably a mix of both, and it probably varies a lot individually, honestly. Mike in Richmond Hill asks, who should the leadoff hitter be going forward with Horwitz in the mix now? Against righties, I'm fine with Horwitz. Like I've said on the show, I like a high on-base percentage in the leadoff spot. You know, ideally that would come with a little bit more speed, but the Jays don't have someone who satisfies that. No idea why so many people are walking into the studio today. A high OBP person, ideally with some speed. The Jays don't have that right now. Just get someone in there who can get on base a little bit, set something up. Spencer Horwitz is an option. They'll explore George Springer being an option again at some point in the season, I'm sure. If other guys were hitting more in a power production spot, the way Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s season has gone, where the power hasn't been there, but the batting average and on base really has, you know, that makes sense, but that requires other guys to be hitting capably of the 3 spot, of the 4 spot, things like that. And they don't have that right now. I do think David Schneider should probably move back down into one of the more run producing spots in the lineup. The leadoff experiment has made sense. He is struggling right now, and I don't think it's really related to being the leadoff hitter, but his profile to me is more of like a 4, 5, 6 kind of hitter anyway. So I think we'll see Horwitz in there a lot against right-handed pitching, which is the case tonight and tomorrow. Brad in Scarborough says, in an ideal scenario, which relief pitchers pitch the 7th, 8th, 9th for the Blue Jays? Right now, like with who's available, that's a tougher one because they don't have a lot of guys available. Romano and Swanson were penciled into 2 of those spots. And Romano's obviously hurt. Swanson is in AAA. So, and the other part of this is if it's 7, 8, 9, I personally care more about what part of the order is up. Like if you're, you know, if you're facing the Orioles, I want Jimmy Garcia for the top of the order, even if it's the seventh. I just want Jimmy Garcia in the highest leverage spot, even though it's been a little shakier of late. But for the purposes of this question, I would say probably Jimmy Garcia in the ninth, Chad Green in the eighth, Trevor Richards or Zach Pop in the seventh. Unless there's a lefty heavy one, in which case, yeah, you mix Meza in. It's not great. The bullpen is not, I know it's been a little better lately, but it is not the sharpest and deepest of bullpens right now, especially at the back end. We'll wrap it up with Justin in Sudbury. Says who is your pick to be Toronto's all-star this season? It's probably going to be Vlad based on overall offensive line and based on fan voting. We'll see how that one goes. Right now, though, I'd probably go Yusei Kikuchi if I had to pick one. That's it for the show today. Thank you to Eric Thames for coming on, Shai Davidi, Derek Van Riper, Joe Siddle. It is Yusei Kikuchi against Carlos F. Rodriguez. Tonight, I'll be on Blue Jay Central a little later to break down Carlos F. Rodriguez a little bit more about his profile and his repertoire. That game goes at 8:10. Dan, Joe, and Hazel on the call. Jamie and Caleb, Blue Jay Central. Ben and Chris on the radio broadcast. We will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break this one down and set up a 2 p.m. game and talk to Shawn Michaels.